I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. My guest, psychologist Lawrence Steinberg, just received a prestigious award from the Jacobs Foundation in Switzerland for his groundbreaking work on adolescent behavior and brain development. The award comes with $1 million Swiss francs for research and dissemination. Steinberg has argued that one of the reasons that teenagers engage in risky, even criminal behavior is because the part of their brain that controls impulses is still developing. He was a consultant in a Supreme Court case in 2005, Roper v. Simmons, that overturned the death penalty for juveniles, and he was a consultant on a case just argued before the Supreme Court involving the constitutionality of life sentences for juveniles who commit serious crimes. And Lawrence Steinberg is a psychology professor at Temple University. He's written numerous scholarly books, including Rethinking Juvenile Justice and the 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. And Lawrence Steinberg, it's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on this award.
Thank you. It's been a pretty wild time.
I was wondering about this wild time, getting that phone call.
Yeah, you know, it isn't like what you read about. The phone call comes out of the blue, and somebody tells you you've won this prize, and then they tell you what the actual prize is, and you kind of can't believe it. And it does take a while to really sink in. And I'm not sure that it really has sunk in fully for me. I got the call from them in late September, but the announcement was embargoed for a long time, so only my family and some close friends knew about it for a very long time.
But does it also tell us that there is interest in this notion of adolescent and brain development, something that you've been doing for some time now?
Yes, in some ways. I mean, I think that that's much more important than who the individual is. This is going to be awarded every year, and it is, the as far as we can tell, the largest prize given to a social scientist other than the Nobel in economics. So it's a huge statement about the importance of this area. I mean, we're used to hearing about people winning prizes for biomedical research. It's rare for social science research other than economics. And to say, look, this is a very, very important area of inquiry, I think is very good. I think it's good for developmental scientists and certainly good for people who study adolescents.
Well, let's cover some of this territory. And we've done this before on Radio Times, but it's always important and worth talking about. How is then a teenage brain different from an adult brain in the most sort of basic sense?
Sure. Well, there really are three things that are changing during adolescence in the brain that are important and that have been important for our arguments about legal policy. The first is that early in adolescence, there is a kind of an arousal of parts of the brain, systems of the brain that are active when we experience reward. And we think that this arousal leads kids to become more interested in sensation-seeking and thrill-seeking and novelty-seeking, because they tend to pay more attention to the potential rewarding aspects of a risky choice than to the costs.
That's dopamine, right?
That's dopamine related, exactly. The second change is one that you mentioned when you introduced me, which has to do with parts of the brain that are active in things like impulse control and planning and foresight. That part of the brain is still maturing during adolescence and well into the 20s. Although, of course, kids can control their impulses, it's not a black and white yes or no thing. They're not as good as adults are, and they don't think ahead as much as adults do. So that's a second important change. And the third one, which has gotten less attention, has to do with the building of better connections between and among different regions of the brain. Hmm. And so the parts of the brain that are very active when we process emotions, let's say, are now communicating better with parts of the brain that are active when we engage in deliberative decision-making. And this coordination of thinking and feeling plays an important role in mature behavior. We think it's very important, for instance, in resisting peer pressure, which increases as people move through adolescence and into adulthood.
Does that mean you're looking at MRIs? You're looking at X-rays of the brain? What kind of material are you looking at in order to see some of these differences and this development?
Well, at Temple, we're doing two things. We are doing some fMRI research. My colleague Jason Chine, who's a neuroscientist, and I are currently looking at What happens inside the brains of kids and adults when they're being watched and observed by their peers? One finding from our
lab, hanging out, you mean?
Well, yeah, although we can't really have them hanging out in the imaging facility, but what we do is we have the subject in the magnet, in the fMRI magnet, doing some risk-taking tasks in there, and his or her friends are in the next room, and they're mic'd into the magnet, and they can see the subject's performance on a computer monitor in the room that they're in. And so we compare how individuals perform these tasks when they know their friends are watching them versus when they know their friends can't see what they're doing. And what we're finding is really fascinating, and it's preliminary. We're in the process of writing it up now. What we're finding is that the presence of peers has very little effect on adults. In other words, the systems of their brain that are active when they're doing these tasks are no different when they're alone versus when they're watched by their friends. But in teenagers, and to a certain extent young adults, the presence of peers activates this dopamine-related system, which we think makes kids much more focused on rewards. And so one of our tasks is a driving task where it's a situation that we've all been in. You're driving along, a light turns yellow, you're trying to get someplace in a hurry, you're trying to decide whether to run the light or not. When adolescents are doing that task and they're being watched by their friends, they run the light more often and they crash the car more often. And the part of their brain that is pushing them toward rewards and toward sensation seeking is activated in ways that it's not activated when they're doing it by themselves. So that's one model that we're using at Temple.
How, though, do you tease apart the kind of information that you're getting about brain function and brain development and all the other influences on teenagers? I mean, whether it is peers or whether it is the family that they grow up in or the style of parenting that their parents have?
Well, I think that this distinction between what's biological and what's environmental is a false distinction. I mean, the environment gets into our brain. And we know that the brain is a plastic, malleable organ that is affected by experience. And so it doesn't really make a great deal of sense to say, well, this phenomenon is biological and this other one is contextual. Everything we do is going to have some reflection in the way that our brain functions. It has to, because our brain is what is controlling our behavior. How much of the way adolescents are is determined by maturation. And how much of it is determined by experience is something that we don't really fully understand. And of course, as in most things, human behavior is going to be influenced by both of them in some interactive process.
But is it possible to say then that children growing up in chaotic households where there's domestic violence, where there's a lot of yelling and screaming, that actually is affecting the brain and maybe even creating some of the behaviors that you've been talking about?
Yes, we aren't doing that kind of research, but there is some terrific stuff that's being done by other scientists. One that comes to mind is a fellow by the name of Seth Pollock, who's at the University of Wisconsin, who has found that kids who are maltreated early in life show different patterns of brain development and brain activation as they get older. And they respond differently when they're exposed to negative emotions, people yelling and screaming, so forth. So the brain does change in response to sort of toxic environmental stimuli. This is not something that we know a tremendous amount about. For one thing, it's hard to study it experimentally.
Sure.
We're not going to do experiments where we expose kids to terrible things. There are good animal models of this in which animals are stressed and in which we look at their brain function and structure. And there's no question that brain development is affected by experience.
Are there gender developments, gender-based developments as well that affect brain and behavior?
There are sex differences in brain development, but they're pretty small. And I would say that the similarities between male and female brain development are so much more striking than the differences that I wouldn't make a big deal about it. I know there are people out there who try to promote this notion that we should educate boys and girls differently. I don't see any evidence for that at all. The differences are so small in magnitude in most respects that they probably have very little implication for how people behave.
But is it possible to say that this is an adolescent brain, and I'm, you know, I'm holding this invisible brain over here, this is an adult brain, and that they are two different organs in a way? And that there's, I guess what I'm trying to get to is this notion of development and evolution over time. And sort of when does an adolescent brain become an adult brain?
Well, to answer the first question, yes. I mean, there's no question that you could, that we can, or one can measure structural differences between an adolescent brain and an adult brain in terms of the relative proportions of gray matter and white matter, in terms of the connections that can be seen between different brain regions and so on. The second question is trickier. That is the question of when does an adolescent brain become an adult brain, for a couple of reasons. The most important one is that, you know, the brain is not a sort of a unitary thing. I mean, different parts and different systems develop along different timetables. So, for instance, parts of the brain that are important for memory, for example, reach adult levels of maturation very early in adolescence. And if you give people memory tests, 15-year-olds will perform just as well as adults will. Parts of the brain that are important for impulse control, which we were talking about earlier, don't reach adult levels of maturation until the mid-20s. And therefore, in our lab and other people's labs, we find if we give people tests of impulse control, that kids don't perform as well as adults do. So it really depends on what part of the brain you're talking about and what aspect of behavior you're talking about.
We've about a minute before our break here, but from your research, you have taken positions, cases actually before the U.S. Supreme Court involving adolescents, criminal behavior, and responsibility. What's your position on that?
Well, mainly my position is that I think that these decisions ought to be informed by what we know about science. And so if I am an advocate in this arena, it's advocating for using good evidence to make these decisions rather than advocating for a specific policy. That said, I think that the science suggests that adolescents are different from adults. And to the extent that we want to emphasize those differences, we ought to treat them differently under the law.
And just because we have a little more time here, but that they are responsible for their behaviors, but not responsible the way adults are.
Yeah, we like to think of them as being less guilty. And under American criminal law, the degree to which we punish people is supposed to be tied to the degree to which we think they're responsible for what they did. That's why we punish premeditated crimes more than impulsive crimes. And so my colleagues and I have argued that if kids are less responsible for their behavior than adults are, we shouldn't punish them in the same way.
Let's take that short break and get back, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Lawrence Steinberg is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University, just received a prestigious award from the Jacobs Foundation based on his years of research looking at adolescents and brain development. He's, as I said, a professor at Temple University, author of a number of books, including The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting, Rethinking Juvenile Justice, much more to talk about. Give us a call here on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Arden Theatre Company supports WHYY and presents Rabbit Hole by David Lindsay Abair. Rabbit Hole tells the story of a family struggling to hold on to each other after a tragic loss. How do you find hope when the unthinkable happens? Told with humor, grace, and humanity, Rabbit Hole reveals the ties that bind a family together and a love that endures. Rabbit Hole tickets are available by phone at 215-922-1122 or on the web at ardentheatre.org.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, sports medicine specialists discuss staying fit despite the aches and pains of aging. This afternoon's forecast, cloudy skies, high 57 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight, low falling back to 44. Overcast tomorrow, there's a slight chance of a shower. Wednesday's high 56. Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, high 58 degrees. And Friday, cloudy, windy, with showers at times, high 48.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll speak with Lowell Bergman, the investigative reporter whose new Frontline documentary talks about the predatory practices of the credit card industry. Also, our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, with a few recipes for side dishes, quick and easy. Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with psychologist Lawrence Steinberg from Temple University. He has said the teenage brain is like a car with a hyperactive accelerator and an underperforming set of brakes. He's been studying adolescents' brain development for many years. He's weighed in on two important Supreme Court cases about juveniles and the law, one involving the death penalty, the other life in prison. And as I said at the top of the hour, just received a prestigious award for his research from the Jacobs Foundation in Switzerland. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about these two Supreme Court cases and one that was argued most recently. But based on what you just said about adolescent responsibility and being, I guess, less guilty than their adult counterparts, how then should teenagers be held responsible for their bad behavior?
Well, let's begin by agreeing that kids ought to be held accountable for what they do, and that bad deeds ought to be punished, and that the community needs to be protected against people who are dangerous, even kids who are dangerous. Having said that, I think it's important to hold kids accountable in a way that is developmentally appropriate, that is going to return them to the community perhaps in better shape than when they went into the justice system, so that they're less dangerous, and that is going to make some effort at rehabilitating them and at preparing them to assume the roles of adulthood in a responsible way. Now, you know, the debates that are currently active about these cases and these issues, the death penalty is no longer currently active because it's been abolished for kids.
A couple of years ago.
But this question of life without parole, I think it's important to remember that these are for very, very, very serious crimes. Most of the crimes that adolescents commit are nowhere near this level of seriousness, but yet we still treat kids in a very harsh and punitive way, even when their crimes are not violent crimes. And that's one of the practices in the justice system that my colleagues and I find most objectionable, which is that we really disrupt kids' lives for crimes that are really not all that terrible.
In fact, from some testimony you gave about a year ago I was at the Brookings Institution on juveniles and the law, you said several things. One was the kids in the adult system are more likely to reoffend. I mean, that's one of your findings.
Right.
And why is that?
Well, the kids who go into the adult system, and we've done research comparing those kids with kids that have committed the same crime and that have similar backgrounds, but who go into the juvenile system. So in the adult system, you don't get any rehabilitation as compared to the juvenile system.
It's just not designed for that,
It's
right?
not designed for that. I mean, I think that that's too bad because I think we should try to rehabilitate adults as well, but we don't, or we don't any longer. In the adult system, kids come into contact with hardened criminals, and so they're learning the tricks of the trade from people with a long history of offending. And kids are often traumatized in the adult system. We know that rates of rape are much higher. Rates of suicide are much higher. It's a scary, more dangerous place. And so to me, it's not surprising that they come out worse and that they reoffend more and more seriously.
But are you also saying that the punishment, the punitive actions for criminal behavior are not effective with juveniles?
They're less effective with juveniles than they are with adults. And I can tie this back real briefly to a study that we've done that's coming out soon in which we it's a gambling task in which we manipulate the rewards and the punishments that you get for winning or losing on particular kinds of bets. It's a card pulling task. And what we find is that during the first half of adolescence, kids are very attentive to rewards, and they're completely oblivious to the punishments.
To the consequences.
To the negative consequences. So they pay attention to the positive consequences, but not to the negative ones. As people get older, they pay increasingly more attention to the costs of bad decisions. And there is other research done by other people suggesting that our responsiveness to rewards comes online and develops earlier and faster than our responsiveness to punishment during this time period.
So does that, because I know when you look at boot camps, they have proved to be largely, I guess, ineffective in terms of dealing with juveniles and reoffending?
Well, they're worse than ineffective. I mean, they're what scientists call iatrogenic, which means that they actually create their own problems on top of the problems that they were supposed to solve. And in our research, some of which is done here in Philadelphia, what we find is that the harshness of a punishment, of a sanction, that a juvenile offender receives is not predictive of whether that person reoffends or not. So we have a paper coming out soon that shows that kids are just as likely to reoffend if they get long sentences after they're released as if they get short sentences. The notion that we deter kids by punishing them very severely finds no support in the empirical science whatsoever.
But so conversely, then, does being more supportive of kids, more sort of therapizing in the more traditional sense, is that more effective then in terms of rehabilitating kids?
Yes. I mean, there are things that work for juvenile offenders, even for very serious juvenile offenders, but the ones that tend to work the best are therapeutic efforts that involve not only the adolescent, but the adolescent's family, that improve the quality of the parenting, the quality of the home environment, the relationship between the family and the school. And there are a number of these programs that have demonstrated not only effectiveness, but cost effectiveness, which is another issue. Let me just mention this. The cost of treating a juvenile offender in the community is probably about a quarter or a fifth of the cost of locking that person up. And let's just say for purposes of argument that they have equal effectiveness. We think that treating them in the community actually is more effective. Mm-hmm. Even if they just have equal effectiveness, it's a tremendous waste of money to lock as many kids up as we do. Kids who are dangerous need to be incarcerated to protect the community until we're relatively sure that they're not dangerous anymore. But a lot of kids are locked up who aren't dangerous.
You were at the Supreme Court, the most recent argument having to do with life in prison for people who commit crimes, serious crimes, as juveniles. What did you hear? What did you come away from?
There were two cases. They were argued back to back. Both involved an individual who committed a crime during adolescence. In each case, these were non-homicides, which makes these cases especially interesting. One was 13 when he committed the crime, and one was 17, both quite serious crimes. Mm-hmm. There are a couple things that were interesting. The first is that in contrast to the discussion that went on when the court looked at the juvenile death penalty, the justices essentially stipulated that adolescents are different from adults. There was no argument about that at all, whereas there had been some argument about that 5 years ago. That partly reflects, I think, the fact that the science has accumulated over that period of time, and people pretty much accept this to be the case. The main dividing line, it seems to me, is over how we should take immaturity into account, not whether we should take it into account. And so you've got a number of justices who essentially say, look, we should take this into account, but we should do it on a case-by-case basis. So I believe it was Justice Alito who said, well, suppose we have somebody who's 17 years old, 11 months and 364 days, and he's done a really terrible thing, and he has a terrible history. Should we really not punish him this way because he's one day short of being 18? Why don't we just look at this on a case-by-case basis? And that was a position taken by Chief Justice Roberts as well. On the other side, you have individuals, I think Justice Breyer was the one who was most vocal about this, who said, look, it is morally repugnant to take children and to lock them up for life. And these were cases not just about life in prison, but life without the possibility of parole.
So never, ever getting out.
Right. Throwing away the key. And Justice Breyer and I think some of the others who are tend to be more liberal in their voting just find it unconscionable that society would do that to somebody who's a minor and who's treated as a minor in so many other ways under the law, which is the strange craziness about all this, that kids that we hold to adult standards of criminal responsibility, we don't let see R-rated movies, or we don't let vote, or we don't let serve on juries because we say they're too immature to do those things. Well, they don't magically become mature because they've committed a crime.
But from your perspective, are you saying, sort of like the death penalty, which is that adolescents are different, their impulse control is different, their brain is responding to peers and situations in a different kind of way, and that they don't, they need their own, I mean, we have a juvenile justice system, but that they should not be treated like adults, even in really serious crimes?
I think that there are some cases where it may be appropriate to refer a juvenile offender to the adult system. And in Rethinking Juvenile Justice, my co-author, Elizabeth Scott, who's a law professor, and I say, well, we should limit involvement in the adult system to kids who are repeat offenders, to kids who are relatively older within the adolescent range, and to kids that are violent and dangerous. And one reason for that is that you don't want those kids coming into contact with other juveniles who are going to be hurt by them or badly influenced by them. And a second is that if they're repeat violent offenders, they've demonstrated, perhaps, that we don't have what it takes in the juvenile system to get these kids to change. But I think that's a very, very small proportion of kids.
In fact, you and others have said that when you look at juveniles who have committed crimes, most of them do not reoffend.
More than 90% of them as adults are not criminals. Now, there's a substantial recidivism rate among juvenile offenders during adolescence, but very little crime is committed by people who are older than 25 for all kinds of reasons, one of which is that it living the life of a criminal is exhausting. And it's something that only kids can really manage for that long a period of time. And once people settle into roles of marriage and work, they're not compatible with a criminal lifestyle.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers into the conversation. Our guest is psychologist Lawrence Steinberg, and he studies psychological development during adolescence and also has done research surrounding risky, even criminal behavior in children and youth. He's the recipient of a $1 million or Swiss franc award by the Jacobs Foundation. That's a foundation in Switzerland. On his research, and he joins us today on Radio Times to get us up to speed on what he's been studying and its impact on the law, on adolescent development, even on families as well. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Martha from East Falls to join our conversation. Hi, Martha. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, I don't know, Larry, if you've seen the article, the recent article by Michael Males in the Journal of Adolescent Research.
I have.
Yeah, and he mentions you a lot.
Yes, he does.
And he's with the Center on Juvenile Criminal Justice in San Francisco, and we'd love to have you comment on his claim. He mentions, I guess his main point, I think, is that poverty has a much larger factor in risk-taking rather than brain development, and he claims that all kinds of statistics, health, demographic, crime, show that adolescents don't necessarily take excessive risks compared to adults, that it's much more associated with poverty, and that I think he also says that middle-aged adults exposed to the same levels of poverty would display similar or even higher levels of crime, violent death, firearms, mortality, etc. So could you comment on that?
Sure, Martha, I appreciate the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Mike is one of those persons who is not going to be dissuaded by facts. We've looked at some of his allegations and looked at the data that he cites, and he's just wrong in many of those cases. He is correct in that there is a relationship between poverty and risky behavior, but he is absolutely incorrect when he states that middle-aged adults take more risks or as many risks as adolescents do. He's also, you know, one of these persons. There are a couple people out there who are, frankly, I'm not sure what their hidden agenda is, but they're very dismissive of the brain research in general, and they've accused not only me but other scientists as well of a kind of biodeterministic view of adolescence. I can only say that I just finished reviewing about a dozen or so articles for a special issue of a very excellent journal, Brain and Cognition, that's devoted to adolescent brain development. And there is no question that the adolescent brain is different than the adult brain. Now, what we do about that is something that we can debate, but it's not debatable that the adolescent brain is different than the adult brain.
Do the critics sort of borrow from that so-called Twinkie defense, the idea that because an adolescent's brain is different, they're held to a different standard of responsibility and therefore are not held fully accountable for their acts?
Well, what they tend to say is that adolescents are the way they are in American society because we make them immature by the way that we treat them. And it has nothing to do with their brain development. So if adolescents behave in ways that we don't like, it's because we don't give them enough responsibility. We allow too many of them to grow up in poverty and so forth. As I said earlier, I think that the distinction between what's biological and what's environmental is a false distinction anyway. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that there's any question at all, and I don't know any neuroscientist who would debate whether there is substantial brain development going on during adolescence that has important implications for how they behave.
Is it possible, based on this research, to predict who might, engage in risky or even dangerous criminal behavior, who might not?
Yes, a little bit. I want to be cautious here. There clearly are risk factors for engaging in criminal behavior. And sociologists and criminologists and psychologists have been studying these risk factors for decades. And so growing up, we talked before about growing up in a chaotic, harsh family environment is a risk factor for engaging in antisocial behavior. But there's a difference between making these very broad predictions about variables that are related to each other versus making what we would call clinical predictions, where you look at an individual and predict that that person is going to commit crime. We can't do that.
Right. Can you imagine, though, and I guess the research would have to get pretty sophisticated, that you could have as evidence in a courtroom someone's MRI? Would you want that?
I don't think that you would want evidence of someone's MRI introduced as a defense or as a mitigating factor. For one reason is that we don't know enough yet about the relationship between individual brain functioning and individual behavior. I think that brain information in the form of an MRI could be helpful for somebody that has a tumor that might be affecting their behavior in a way that ought to be taken into account, or a brain lesion or injury, but not to look at kind of normal brain development, not yet, and maybe not ever.
And not ever. And why not ever, do you think? I mean, just because of what you said about individuals and perhaps even the inability to actually predict behavior based on signs.
There's a... I think that the public thinks that neuroscience is more precise than it really is. That somehow you dress somebody up in a white lab coat and you show a picture of a brain, and now this is more compelling evidence than giving somebody a psychological test and so forth. Any good neuroscientist will tell you that it is not as precise as people have been led to believe that it is. Most of the studies in which you see adolescent brains compared to adult brains are pictures of composites of many individuals' brains. And if you looked at any one of them, it might not look like the composite. So we're talking about averages rather than individuals.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. And Martha, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Psychologist Lawrence Steinberg from Temple University is our guest today on the show. Just awarded a prestigious award from the Jacobs Foundation in Switzerland for his groundbreaking work on adolescent behavior and brain development, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Give Philly is proud to support WHYY. Give Philly is a partnership of Philadelphia youth and family service organizations that dedicate each day to enriching communities and making Philadelphia a better place for all, especially for those most in need. More about the initiative and ways to support those who help strengthen the city is available online at www.givephilly.org. Give Philly, together for youth, for families, for Philadelphia.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, sports medicine specialists discuss staying fit despite the aches and pains of aging. This afternoon's forecast, a high of 57 degrees under cloudy skies. Partly cloudy overnight, low falling back to 44. Overcast tomorrow. There's a slight chance of a shower. Wednesday's high, 56 degrees. For Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy. Thursday's high, 58. Then Friday, cloudy with a chance of showers, high 48 degrees.
There are radio stories, and then there are the best radio stories. Join me, Gwen Maxey, for the 2009 Third Coast broadcast featuring the winners of our annual documentary competition. Tales of fate and luck, reunions and taboos, loyalty and betrayal from the Third Coast Festival and PRI. Intrigued? Tune in.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's get back to our callers. We've got Steve from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. You've touched a little bit on my question, but I think of the domestic animals we have at home as kind of permanent toddlers. And in similar way, I'm wondering how much you've looked at how certain brain differences in adults might make someone closer to a permanent teenager in terms of the impulse control, et cetera. And I'm thinking about things like ADD, aphasias, things like that.
That's an interesting question, Steve. Lauren Steinberg, go ahead.
Well, we're asked that question a lot with reference to some of these legal issues. So for instance, a question that I'm asked very frequently is, look, if immature decision-making is going to mitigate somebody's criminal responsibility, why limit it to adolescents? Why not cut some slack for adults who are immature? After all, we all know adults who sure behave more like teenagers than like adults. And the answer, I think, is that there's a difference between immaturity that people grow out of through the process of normal maturation and immaturity that they are never going to overcome. So I think that for the most part, the vast majority, nearly all, impulsive 16-year-olds are going to turn into normal adults with normal impulse control. But the vast majority of 30-year-olds who are still behaving impulsively like 16-year-olds are going to be that way all the time. So while we haven't looked at the brain differences between immature and non-immature adults, I'm certain that they're there. As I was saying before, there's nothing that we do that isn't reflected somehow in the brain. But I don't think that the logic that applies to treating adolescents under the law the way that we think they ought to be treated applies to treating immature adults that way.
And when is a brain fully developed? I realize there's some variation there, but generally speaking.
I think that's a really hard question to answer. A lot of the systems that we are interested in seem to be fully mature in the mid to late 20s. So there is still some development going on. But as I mentioned before, there are brain systems and brain regions that are fully mature very early in adolescence.
So kids driving at 16, drinking at 18, or I guess it's 21 now, right? It was changed. But these are all sort of acknowledgments, although 16-year-olds, as we know, are not necessarily the best drivers in the world. But these are sort of acknowledgments about certain, I guess, developmental milestones that young people have?
Well, you know, I think that these ages were chosen for a variety of reasons, probably very few of which have anything to do with science. I mean, when most of these ages were established, we didn't have the capacity to do brain imaging research. But I think that in general, the fact that it's usually somewhere around this period between 16 and 21 that we phase in adult responsibilities is reflective of our intuitive understanding that there's important change going on at this time. I mean, the one glaring exception is this idea of trying 12 and 13-year-olds as adults, which is a real outlier compared to everything else that we do.
And this is part of that get tough approach with juveniles and crime that goes back about 20, 25 years.
Right. It started when the crime rate rose quite substantially during the late 70s and 1980s, and there was a lot of get tough on crime rhetoric that led to the passage of a lot of laws that frankly, probably have had harmful effects, not not helpful ones. And it's also reflected in this movement towards zero tolerance in schools, where, again, I think we've lost sight of the fact that kids are different from adults, that we shouldn't expect them to behave in exactly the same way that adults do, and that the response to a misbehaving child is not to criminalize that child's behavior. And I use criminalize here, with a small c, but I think zero tolerance in some ways is kind of a criminalization of very often normal behavior in school. Kids fight. I mean, we kids have always fought, but usually these problems were handled in the assistant principal's office, maybe with the help of parents, and not referred to the legal system, which doesn't make a great deal of sense to me.
And there are those cases. Obviously, you want to keep guns and other weapons out of schools, but there are those cases of, you know, a six-year-old with a plastic spoon, and that's viewed as some kind of a dangerous weapon.
Right. I mean, I think that that sometimes these policies are carried out to the point of insanity, where no one really looking at it, even the most get tough on crime people in the world, would say that a child who's pointing a chicken bone at somebody, which there is a famous case of that, should be thrown out of school for threatening somebody with an aggressive act. Look, it is important to have discipline in schools, in the same way that it's important to hold juveniles accountable when they commit crimes. But there are better ways to do it than this.
Let me get back to our callers. We got, looks like Eric from Palatine joining us on Radio Times. Eric, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Steinberg. I'm a pediatric intern, and as someone who has counseling responsibilities for adolescents, I was wondering, you know, you've been talking about the societal implications of your research, but in terms of people who have counseling responsibilities, either as professionals or as parents, what's sort of the bottom line? I was intrigued when you said that positive reinforcement, for instance, was more, you know, important than negative reinforcement. What's sort of the bottom line boiled down to what you do when you have a limited amount of time to speak with an adolescent?
It's a great question, Eric. Go ahead, Lawrence Steinberg.
Well, I think, of course, it depends on what the counseling is about. But it seems to me that one important lesson from this work is that kids often seem smarter intellectually than their emotional maturity. And I think it's important for counselors and for parents and for teachers to recognize that there's so much development in so many different areas going on during this very narrow time period that it's important to look at the whole adolescent and to try to make some assessment of this individual kid's strengths and weaknesses. But that, going back, I think, to the heart of your question, is that supportiveness and forming a bond with the adolescent, and this is for teachers as well as for counselors and for parents, is what's going to motivate kids to behave in the way that we want them to behave, rather than punitiveness.
And you've written a book about this, or I guess co-wrote a book about this, this has to do with good parenting, but warmth and firmness, I guess, are your sort of pillars here. Empathy, rules, consistency, expectations, all of that.
Right. Adolescents become physically mature before they become intellectually mature, and they become intellectually mature before they become emotionally mature, and it's important to have some sense of what the developmental timetable is.
Let me get Grace from Pottstown to join us. Hi, Grace. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there.
Hi. I have read and heard many anecdotes about infants and young children who have been traumatized in their life, either by neglect or by moving around from one caretaker to another, and that as a result, their brain was not able to develop properly in those infant and toddler stages. And part of it being like not understanding empathy, cause and effect, and things like that. And I wonder how many of our juveniles have been traumatized really, really in their infancy and toddlerhood. And there is this thing called, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with, neurological reorganization, or sometimes it's called patterning, where they try to make up for that by imitating crawling movements and things like that. And I wondered how much of that might help adolescents who may not have developed the kind of impulses that they should have.
Well, Grace, let's take your question and see what Lawrence Steinberg has to say. Thanks for calling into Radio Times.
There certainly is a lot of evidence that that there are higher rates of early childhood and infant trauma in the juvenile offender population than in the community. I think that's probably not a surprise. And we also know, as I mentioned earlier, that early traumatic experience can affect the brain in permanent ways. And as the caller points out, it can affect the brain in ways that are very important for the way we process emotions. And empathy is part of that package. I'm not familiar with research that suggests that the sort of patterning that you described has any effect. But I will say that just because somebody has a history of poor impulse control doesn't mean that there aren't things that can be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, cognitive behavioral therapy can be very effective in helping individuals learn to control anger and to control impulsive behavior. So I think we don't want to look at the brain as a kind of an all-determining organ that makes us behave in ways that we have no control over. It's possible to learn and possible to overcome brain development that has gone awry because of early experience.
And you find that cognitive either counseling or therapy is more effective with adolescents, which I guess focuses on behavior, getting them to look at things that they do, their reactions to things that they do.
In the reviews that have been done on what works for juvenile offenders, cognitive behavior therapy has been sort of certified by these very, very rigorous scientific reviews as an effective intervention for juvenile offenders with anger control difficulties.
And just because it gets them to look at themselves in sort of non-threatening and very concrete kinds of ways.
Right, because a lot of the impulsive behavior that kids engage in comes from misinterpreting and misattributing other people's behavior as threatening when it's really not threatening.
Let me get Martin from Center City. Grace, thanks for the call. And Martin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank
there.
You.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Steinberg. I wrote one of the first papers on cognitive behavior therapy in the 1960s. And I'd like to support what Dr. Steinberg is saying about early development and so forth.
Sure.
But I also think that we need to look at our criminal justice system, which is failing. If you look at every other developed country, the recidivism rate is lower for children and for adults. And the numbers of criminals placed in the system is much, much lower. France only has 60,000 people in the criminal justice system. So I think that there's a real need to look at our broken system, which is, as Dr. Steinberg has pointed out, is a school for criminals. You have older criminals teaching younger criminals how to do different kinds of crime.
Well, you know what? Let me take your call, and I'm seeing Lawrence Steinberg nodding his head vigorously, Martin, as you're describing the situation. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. We, for some of the work that we were doing with the MacArthur Foundation's support, we commissioned a review of what do we know about what works and what doesn't work, and how widely used are these. And what we found, the good news is that there are a number of programs that are effective and that are cost-effective. The bad news is that by the estimate of this researcher who was from RAND, who did this work for us, Peter Greenwood, only 5% of kids who get treatments in the juvenile justice or criminal justice systems get a scientifically proven treatment. So part of the problem with our justice system is that a lot of things are done that are either ineffective or that actually make things worse. If we could get localities and states to implement evidence-based practices, we would really drastically improve the success of our justice system.
But do you think that's politics in part? I mean, obviously you're talking about a disconnect between the science and the system, but that, again, we're back to this get tough approach with juveniles.
It's politics in part. It's because people have very strong and passionate beliefs about how to make children behave. And so you have some politician who says, you know, all these kids need is to go to boot camp for a while and that's going to fix their problem. And then legislation gets passed that does that when, in fact, boot camp turns out not to be effective. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what's done is done kind of intuitively and to use a word we've used a lot today, impulsively, without a lot of deliberation and without a lot of evidence.
Let me get Jeff from Reading to join our conversation. And Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, I just want to use a practical approach to what the doctor is saying.
Sure.
You know, when I was a teenager, and I think pretty much every judge and lawyer and attorney and anybody in the criminal justice system was a teenager, and they did things that were based on being a teenager. I don't think it's really rocket science when you're looking at the pure essence of who you are when you're 15 years old. And using me as an example, I was a rotten kid. I did a lot of horrible things that if I would have gotten caught, I probably would have gone to some type of detention center or some type of prison. And just like the doctors were saying, I would be learning from more experienced criminals and possibly not go in the direction that I went. I got married when I was 25, and everything from there on stopped. I started three nonprofits. I'm a professional. What would have happened if I would have got caught at 17 doing something bad as a 17-year-old mind, being incarcerated, whether it be in the juvenile detention environment or in an adult prison environment? Now I get to learn from new mentors, and those mentors are professional criminals. Then I come back out on the street. Do I get married? Do I have a family? Do I start the nonprofits? Do I have a professional career? Or do I continue doing the wrong thing?
Well, you and I'm looking at the clock here, because I want to give Lawrence Steinberg a chance to respond to your call, and I'm sure Jeff is not alone.
No, Jeff is not alone. That's what most people would say about their adolescent years, and that's why there are many of us who think that perhaps the most important intervention of all would be to do what we can to keep kids from getting into the justice system, to find a way to respond to their bad behavior in ways that it's not going to disrupt and derail their lives. Because, like Jeff, most people grow out of adolescence, and then they start to be law-abiding and responsible adults.
Jeff, thanks for your call to Radio Times. And Lawrence Steinberg, thank you, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times, and congratulations once again on this award. And Lawrence Steinberg, our guest, he's a professor of psychology at Temple University, and his work focuses on the study of contemporary adolescence and brain development. And he just received a prestigious award from the Jacobs Foundation. He'll be taking that nearly $1 million and plowing it into some research and dissemination on this important issue. And we appreciate your phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member supported public media.